Hello, this is Jason Troy, and I am on BSL Radio, and I have a fantastic guest here today that is going to tell you an awful lot. We could probably be on this call for 3 or 4 days straight, but we will have to limit it. I have Rick Hansen here, and Rick is a neuropsychologist and author of Hardwiring Happiness, The New Brain Science of Contentment, Calm, and Confidence, and Random House. It's in 4 languages as well, so it's all over the world. Buddhist Brain, The Practical Neuroscience of Happiness, Love, and Wisdom. And that's in 24 languages, so it's even more. Just One Thing, Developing a Buddha Brain in One Practice at a Time, and Mother Nurture, A Mother's Guide to Health in Body, Mind, Intimate Relationships. He's the founder of Wellspring Institute for Neuroscience and Contemplative Wisdom and an affiliate of the Greater Good Science Center at UC Berkeley, which I absolutely love, and we actually had a couple people on from there from our podcast, so that's a fantastic place. And he's been invited speaker at Oxford, Stanford, Harvard, and taught in meditation centers around the world. Summa cum laude from UCLA, his work has been featured on BBC, NPR, CBC, Fox Business, Consumer Report, U.S. News and World Report, O Magazines, and on and on and on. And he has a column in Huffington Post, which is excellent, so you should read that every week. And then also on his website, you can find a newsletter, which also is fantastic. So thank you, Rick, for being here today. How's everything going?
It's a pleasure. Thank you. I'm doing great. And let me just amend one small thing you said. The new book, Hardwiring Happiness, is actually out October 8th. But the good news is that there's a nice bonus, a real bonus with no strings attached for pre-ordering it. I gave a workshop about your best brain, and we've turned that workshop into a multimedia presentation. So people can get that bonus program if they pre-order, which will, of course, help me too, so I'd appreciate it. And you can get there by just going to rickhansen.net/hardwiringhappiness. And that'll take you to the pre-order page.
Well, oh, that's fantastic. There you go. You can actually get a lot by pre-ordering the book. And I love October, my birthday month. So thank you, Extra. I appreciate that. See, you already knew we were going to have this interview before we actually were going to have it. So I want to talk about something on here that we actually talked about before the call, and that's, you know, a lot of people are having challenges in their work-life balance, and also just finding happiness inside of their work. And so I wanted to talk about, you know, doing social good, really giving in your own work, and finding some work-life balance. And I'd just love for you to, like, talk about that a little bit with our listeners and audience and kind of what your take on all of that is.
Yeah, well, the short version for me is that we're not going to go back to, all sort of living in a cave together or wandering slowly across the Serengeti chatting away. You know, we're going to have a 21st century kind of life. We're going to be busy. The problem is we got a Stone Age brain. We got a brain that's not adapted for mild to moderate chronic stress with little opportunity for recovery. And while it's great and important, and I really support your efforts, for example, and those of your colleagues to change the outer world for the better, you know, change the environment for the better, I think all that's great. Meanwhile, what are we going to do, right? As best I could tell, that outer environment's changing pretty slowly in terms of becoming more humane. So we got to work from the inside out to build up our inner strength, to create more shock absorbers inside and more cores, if you will, of inner peace, kind of like a deep keel in the water of our personal sailboat going forward through life, so that when things happen to us, they don't knock us over so much. We become more robust, stronger in terms of dealing with them. And for me, that takes us right to the brain, because the brain's the bottom line on that. The brain is the organ in the body that's the source of our inner strengths, fundamentally. So learning how to change your own brain for the better in simple, practical ways using positive experiences is what I've been focusing on lately, because it seems to me like the coolest, best way to do it. A, it feels good. B, it's grounded in brain science.
Yep.
3, it works. C, it works. So anyway, that's my thing about that. Yep.
Awesome. That's fantastic.
Yeah.
So the next topic I wanted to talk about is something I find that people have a really difficult time with, and that is dealing with criticism or conflict with other people. Because typically I find that people tend to lash out And you see this a lot in social media. I mean, not only do you see this with people in person, but you're seeing it online with people having Facebook wars or huge arguments on it and wanting to be right and really not taking the time to understand where people are coming from, and just trying to create a win-lose situation with other people and having to be right. And I just wanted to talk to you. You need to talk about kind of how should you go thinking through criticism, or if people criticize you or you're in those situations with, you know, significant conflict, and how can you handle it and think through, you know, what to do?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that on the one hand, conflict is natural, right? On the other hand, again, if you kind of ground what we're talking about in evolutionary neuropsychology, we're the most social species on the planet, and we evolved to be highly affected by each other. Because if we were not highly affected by each other, we wouldn't have been able to survive in small groups, competing against other groups, you know, over literally millions of years, if you reach all the way back 40 million years to the beginning of the primates altogether. So it's natural to be affected by others. Good news, bad news, right? Someone smiles at you, it's natural to be affected by that. Someone frowns at you, it's natural to be affected by that as well. So what are we going to do about that? And I think that one thing to do about it is to recognize, as I wrote in a recent post, relax, you're going to be criticized. And what I mean by that is that there's an inevitability to criticism. We cannot escape praise and blame, you know, fame and ill repute, to quote the Tibetan proverb. We're all going to get it. So the question is, can we sort through what comes at us and figure out what to deal with it? In other words, sometimes criticism comes at us, and frankly, it's just not accurate. That's it. We don't need to obsess about it. We don't need to worry about it. I liken it a little bit to walking down the street and some poor homeless schizophrenic person looks at you and says, "You're a crocodile, you're a crocodile." You know, you don't start looking at your skin to see if you've acquired scales, right? You just don't take it seriously. You know, consider the source. I don't need to really dwell on this. Or second, sometimes there's a grain of truth mixed in with a lot of other sludge. And I think it's useful to zero in on that grain of truth, take maximum reasonable personal responsibility for it, and then zero out the other person's complaints. It's really hard to not like or promote someone who operates that way, who takes that maximum reasonable personal responsibility for relentlessly and impeccably and sincerely addressing the legitimate core, right, the legitimate grain of truth.
Yep.
In other people's complaints. But that said, just because we're addressing it doesn't mean, this is an important point, doesn't mean that we need to assume that there's a moral fault. What I mean by this is that very often the criticism we receive, and embarrassing to say, me included, sometimes the criticism we deliver has a kind of moralizing, righteous, shaming quality to it, when really it's about either simply a personal preference. How dare you bring me chocolate ice cream? Don't you know I like vanilla? It's just a personal preference. There's nothing evil about bringing someone chocolate ice cream, for example. But sometimes we communicate that way. I couldn't believe that you did. Don't you know that? As if there's some serious fault, you know, related to the criticism, when in fact all it's really about is, like I said, either a personal preference or often some way to be a little more skillful in the future. It wasn't that you really screwed up. It wasn't that you were a bad person. It's just that there's a better way, right, a better way going forward. And so if we can kind of filter out the moral fault finding, which really revs us up as a social species because we're very vulnerable to social shame, if we can separate out the moral fault finding, which goes to the core of our being, and zero in on only what's reasonable and also sort out the moral fault finding from what's skillful correction going forward and what's basically just a matter of preference, then we can be much more proactive ourselves and act unilaterally in our own virtuous ways, in ways that they're going to make us feel better and also are the best odd strategy to elicit good behavior toward us from other people.
Fantastic. So he mentioned a concept in there that has been, you know, in the media and all over, and that's shame. And I want to talk about shame and the brain and just get your take on that, because it's something that so many people feel all these guilty and bad things about themselves, and they really can't get over the process of, you know, getting through that. So you could talk about that a little bit.
Yeah. Well, you know, people basically say guilt is the feeling that I did something bad. Shame is the feeling I am bad. And you can see the distinction there. Shame is very far-reaching. And I, as a psychologist, I want to – they're basically four negative emotion bands, the fear spectrum, the anger spectrum, the sadness spectrum, and the shame spectrum. And these range from very subtle feelings. Like on the fear spectrum, you can range from subtle uneasiness or concern all the way out to freaking out, panic, terror, okay? Similarly, in the shame spectrum, it runs from very subtle feelings of self-doubt or being less than or, you know, not on solid ground in terms of worth or inclusion or being valued by others or feeling valuable, period, all the way to devastating shame, the kind that leads people sometimes, and in some, certainly in some cultures like in Japan, literally to kill themselves. And so in daily life in the business world, you know, it's you know, with rare exceptions, that world is not particularly focused on building up the inner self-worth of people. By the way, self-worth is a feeling really distinct from self-esteem. I've known a lot of people who could, you know, look you in the eye and give you a long list of their personally positive qualities who still feel bad about themselves deep down inside or very insecure and need constant, you know, or need a lot of reassurance to kind of feel okay. So how do we build up this sense of self-worth? Again, that's what really interests me. How do we build up inner strengths? How do we internalize positive qualities with a brain that's like Velcro for the bad but Teflon for the good, right? How do we help good experiences stick to this brain that has a negativity bias so these good experiences can actually build up inner strengths inside, which really means operationally building up positive neural structures. And so for me, the opportunity is when you do recognize that you did something good or are something good, right? Take the extra 5 to 10 to 20 seconds to actually register the experience so it sinks into you, so you can take it with you wherever you go. And then gradually, bit by bit, moment by moment, you can build up the sense inside of your own worth so that when your boss hassles you or when somebody in the next cubicle is snarky or when something doesn't go right or a big sale just drops out from under your feet or someone kind of spins what happened to blame you unfairly, when, not if, right, when those things happen, or in your home life, right, the people you live with, sleep with, grow up with, what have you, kind of diss you, when, not if that happens, you're going to be more robust. You won't be so knocked over by it, and you'll recover a lot more quickly.
That's fantastic. So the next thing I want to talk about is the power of self-compassion. I saw that you had a podcast with Dr. Neff, and we actually have done one as well with her really recently. So I wanted just to see kind of, you know, what your thoughts were on, you know, self-compassion and the power that it can play in your life.
Right. Well, that's really great. So two things on that. Let's see, the first about self-compassion, it sounds really kind of soft, right? And so in a hard-boiled, you know, profit-oriented business world, it kind of raises the question, like, why bother? Is that just self-pity or wallowing, you know? And we don't want to do that, of course. So, no, compassion is simply the wish that a being not suffer, pure and simple. Technically, kindness is the wish that a being be happy. Compassion presupposes some sense of stress or pain or difficulty or challenge or sadness or outright suffering in another person, whereas kindness doesn't assume that, although it does encompass it. So a little bit of a difference there. Though in regular practice, the two, compassion and kindness, tend to blend together. Okay, that said, we can apply compassion and kindness to all beings, including ourselves, including the being who wears our own name tag. And so we can wish that we weren't sad about something. We can wish that we didn't worry. We can wish that we felt better. We can wish that we weren't having to work so hard. We can wish that we had more money. We can wish that we didn't get a scary diagnosis from a doctor recently. We can wish all those things. We can wish that we didn't worry so much or feel so bad about something that happened at work or how another person treated us. This is practical self-compassion. And there's a lot of research that shows that self-compassion is actually a fantastic way to build up strength. It makes us more resilient. It builds up hardiness. It supports the immune system. It promotes physical health. It has a lot of benefits. And it's possible to be self-compassionate, you know, 5-10 seconds straight. I mean, my own kind of first aid kit when something hits the fan is that, first of all, I try to notice it. Like, oh, I'm starting to get irritated here or annoyed or frustrated or pressured or driven or anxious about something. And then second, I get on my own side. You know, I want to help myself. If you're not on your own side, you're dead in the water. You've got to be for yourself. It doesn't mean being against others, but it means being a friend, you know, a good friend to yourself, like you would be a good friend to somebody else. And then third step, self-compassion, you know, a moment of like, ouch, this hurts, a kind of warm-heartedness toward yourself, a sort of caring, you know, a treating yourself like you matter, which is deeply important for everybody, particularly those who have not felt like they mattered enough to others. And then my fourth step is I make a plan. I start figuring out what the heck am I going to do here, including just keeping my mouth shut and riding out the storm or whatever else the plan, you know, call my lawyer or whatever else the plan consists of. All that kind of first aid kit stuff for me goes down usually in less than half a minute. You know, I'm into the plan phase fairly quickly. But there's a place for the self-compassion step in that entire process. And the last thing I'll say, just as, again, a detail, I really like your good-to-good, G2G, you know, structure of what you're up to, the social good aspects. And one thing I'm doing that people might be interested in that you referred to is that I've put up two so far, and I'm about to do a third one, freely offered video series with where I'm interviewing in each case, seven top-tier people, like Kristen Neff, for example, in each one of these series, and they're freely offered. So if you just Google my name, S-O-N, Rick Hansen, and Compassionate Brain, that was the first one I did, Loving Brain, that's the second one I'm doing, Hardwiring Happiness will be the one I do in October. Anyway, you can get that free material, and it's really free. You can download it, keep it, share it, whatever. It's really super cool.
That's awesome. That's fantastic. Yeah. So the next thing, I want you talk about having a purpose and vision in your life and what that do. Because a lot of people, I find, I did this experiment where I walked around and I was talking to people and they were really not my friends and asking people, so, you know, what's your purpose and vision in life? I'm like, because I just wondered if people actually had one. And I found out fairly that very few people have it. And if they do have it, it's all about getting something in their life. It's not really about a larger thing or helping people or inspiring or doing anything else. And a lot of that's attached to getting, you know, external validation, which eventually won't lead to anything positive. So just want to know kind of what your thought is and how to cultivate kind of your purpose and vision in your own life and what importance that you see that has for people.
Yeah. Well, I think that's very interesting. So at a deep level, if you think about the way that you to kind of define my terms here, the way neuroscientists use the word mind, you know, my own background's in neuropsychology and all that. So the way that neuroscientists define mind is information. You know, in other words, the nervous system is an information processor, broadly defined, in a very distributed, extraordinarily complex neural network with, in the brain alone, and of course neurons are distributed all throughout the entire body, in the brain alone there are about 100 billion neurons that on average make about 5,000 connections called synapses with each other, giving us a network inside our head with roughly 500 trillion synapses, right? So it's really quite extraordinary. So in terms of this architecture that starts very simple inside our own body and started 600 million years ago when the nervous system arose back with very simple organisms. So if you go, how can I put it? If you go down the brain, you know, from the top down into the brainstem, in effect, you go back in time. So this architecture of the mind-brain system has goals at all levels. It's goal-directed at all levels. So there's no way around being goal-directed, including at the highest level, let's say, of life purpose or major priorities or values or aims or aspirations in life. We can't not have goals. You know, some people say, oh, we need to be goalless, you know, goal-free. Well, that's a goal. There's no way around having goals.
Yeah.
The question is, do you have good goals and are you effectively moving toward them, right? And that's where I'm going to really focus on your question here. In terms of that, I think that in the brain, basically we pursue goals in a top-down way and a bottom-up way. You know, top-down, we hold them as concepts, often with inner language. Like, for example, one of my core goals is kind of serving the awakening of all beings. I still haven't given up on helping people and so forth. And actually, as I get older, that seems somehow to be more and more important. So serving all beings. But I also have other extremely important priorities, taking care of my kids' welfare. We've got two young adult kids. My wife's been married over 30 years. Our cat, we have an aging cat. I want to help my cat be well, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So you can have goals at different levels. So top down, you know, you make everything from you write your life purpose on a yellow sticky and put it on top of your computer screen, or, you know, you maintain a daily checklist. You know, you can have a range of these. This is the top-down part. The bottom-up part, though, is actually much more powerful. That's where we get a visceral, felt sense in the body of what is it like to fulfill the goal. So what is it like to feel happy? What is it like to be loving? What is it like to be generous toward others?
Yes.
What is it like to be fulfilled? What is it like to feel accomplished or important or successful, meaningful? You know, we're making a big contribution. Or what's it like to feel that, and this is very important for people, that your level of contribution is matched to your level of ability, and also that the level of recognition you're getting is matched to your level of contribution. And when there's a disconnect there, that really tends to eat at people, understandably, because there's a kind of injustice there. So what's that like to feel? And so if you open to feeling it and you give yourself more and more over to feeling it, that will incline you increasingly in that direction, which is what you want, from the bottom up, which is where the deep, ancient, emotional and motivational centers of the brain live, in the subcortical regions with the amygdala and the basal ganglia, et cetera, and also deep down in the brainstem. The other thing is, what's it like to feel deep down in yourself that you are given over to your higher purposes, that you're moving in that direction, that they are the current that draws you, rather than having a kind of stick at your back that's moving you away from the negative? You are intensely pulled toward the positive, you know, your higher purposes. What's that feel like deep down in your body? And then, you know, related to my stuff about taking in the good, hardwiring happiness, you know, building brain structure, when you have that experience, when it's activated in your mind as a mental state, take the extra 10, 20 seconds, and I have a lot of skills about that that are offered out there in the world you can find. Take the extra 10 or 20 seconds to register the positive experience so it sinks into you. So increasingly your brain just automatically takes you in that direction. So to sum up, top down is good, bottom up is better, and when you experience your bottom up purposes and motivations and passions, take the extra 10, 20 seconds to really let them sink in so you build them into your brain structure, weaving them into the fabric of your brain and your life.
Fantastic. I love that. That's awesome for everyone listening.
Oh, cool. Thanks.
That's like three times. So next thing I want to talk to you about is, I love, you have a blog post on here. It says, give them what they want. And I want to talk about, you know, relationships in your brain. And,
not especially if they have a gun in your head, but anyway. Okay,
yes,
give them
exactly
what they want.
That's
keep
awesome
going there.
Yes. Yeah. And I think that's fantastic. And I want to talk about, you know, how that people can really have more successful relationships. And, you know, and part of that is asking and telling and communicating your wants and needs with someone else. And so how can you all do that? How can you do that and create, you know, a win-win situation and create, you know, things that are actually positive instead of, you know, having them look like a bank and always taking a withdrawal out of it?
Right, exactly, or an emotional vampire, or, you know, black
yeah
hole, all those really nasty metaphors, right?
Yeah.
Not a good thing. So, great question. So, partly you're talking about material, you know, that I got into in this chapter in my book, in Buddha's Brain, called kindness and assertiveness, because to me that's the sweet spot. You know, it's relatively easy or straightforward to be strong and assertive and push for what you want, you know, and in a weird, and it also it's relatively straightforward to be sweet, to be nice, to be loving, to be compassionate, to be kind, forgiving, altruistic, cooperative, etc., right? The sweet spot, though, is to be both, to have strength with heart or heart with strength. How do we actually do that bit? That, to me, that's what you're really getting at here. And so to that end, step one, paradoxically, there's the old line, fences make for good neighbors. And in psychology, there are these two major themes. They get languaged or phrased in different ways. The two different themes are autonomy and connection. Or you could say kind of loosely, strength and heart, in other words. And the truth is that they serve each other. They're actually not at odds with each other. But to be able to sustain, and to be able to sustain heart with other people, to give them what they want, as it were, you need to first and foremost take care of yourself. Fences make for good neighbors. You need to have your boundaries there. You need to be for yourself, the thing I said in the very beginning. You need to be on your own side, and you need to be prepared, and hopefully do so in skillful ways, but prepared to be direct with people about getting your needs met in important relationships. So that's kind of first and foremost. That's the foundation here. You know, we're not talking about being on a doormat. We're not talking also about ignoring structural issues where the playing field is frankly tilted against you and nobody wants to name it, but it's the elephant in the room. That there really is, as it were, a glass ceiling that you're bumping up against, or there really is some kind of, difficulty in getting into something, or you're an older person in the workplace, and it really is hard to get a job, and there really is, or other forms, of discrimination or prejudice. Or these issues are out there. That said, now let's talk about this point about giving others what they want. So there are two reasons to do it. One is just out of pure benevolence, right? We like people. We're nice. You know what I mean? Human animals, when we're not being attacked or hungry or frightened, we are actually usually really pretty nice to other people. I was in Manhattan recently. I'm a California guy, although my cultural roots are really Midwestern. My dad was born on a ranch in North Dakota in 1918, still going strong. But Manhattan is not my normal place. I look around here like, I'm not in Kansas anymore, you know what I mean? I'm clearly a rube, right? So I've had repeated moments, though, for all the talk about New Yorkers being tough, hard-boiled folks, I've had repeated moments. I'm standing on a street corner, clearly befuddled. Some busy person will stop for a moment and say, are you lost? I'm clearly lost. They'll straighten me out to where the subway really is that I need to get to, and then, ba-boom, they're gone. It's a 30-second, 40-second interaction, you know what I mean? It's definitely New York style. It's direct, it's to the point, ka-boom. And it's heartfelt, it's helpful, and they're done with it. Why did that stranger stop? That stranger slowed down. Why did that person have to do that? They wanted to do it. That's the way we are. We're naturally benevolent. And besides the moral virtues in benevolence, it also feels good to be benevolent. You know, sidebar, you probably know this, I bet you do already, that there are research studies that show that the pleasure centers in the brain will activate more in studies when people give, if they're given $20 and they're allowed to keep it for themselves or give it to a charity. They get more pleasure by giving it to a charity, for example. All right. The other reason, though, to be to give people what they want is enlightened self-interest. Because, frankly, to put it really bluntly, if you give them what they want, that's the fast track to getting them off your back. In other words, for example, I don't like it when people have a beef with me. Because I'm on my own side, I want to zero in really quickly on the maximum that's reasonable in their issue and start delivering the goods as best I can. I want to zero out their complaint so they don't have a basis for it anymore, partly because I don't like being criticized, partly because I am benevolent, and partly because I realize that if I give them what they want, that puts me on the best possible footing. It's my best odds strategy to get what I want from them, right? This is a perfectly appropriate way to do this. So how I do it a lot is I try to find out what's the deep issue here. You know, very often what people say is really a proxy for the real stakes on the table. You know, for example, they are talking with us about how to load the dishwasher, but the real issue on the table is around they want to feel connected. They want to feel like we're together, right? We're on their side. We're a teammate with them in the undertaking of life. And at a certain level, I could care less about how to load the dishwasher, but the other person wants me to. It makes them feel like we're on the same page if I do it their way. Whatever. Fine. No worries. Let's load the dishwasher your way, right? So feeling down into the deeper issue, the real priority on the table, which often boils down to matters around kind of standing or autonomy or safety. Those are some of our deeper needs. So zeroing in on the deeper needs, then we can really address the real issue. Second, I try to operationalize it. What would it look like if you got what you wanted here? I mean, obviously change the language. I mean, I'm a therapist and I live in California, so I might talk a certain way, but I think local dialects, you know, speak in the language that's appropriate. I've had a lot of business experience and there are ways to speak, you know, when you're hanging with a friend that are just not appropriate in a workplace environment or vice versa. And so you want to find a way to say it. But essentially, let's operationalize it. What would it look like if you got what you wanted? Focus on the future, for example, too. We can argue about the past. It's usually a dead end. No, there's no cheese down that tunnel. Let's focus on going forward. So what would it actually look like, particularly in as concrete a terms as we can get it, you know, in terms of how I would behave, the words I would use, the deliverables you'd get, the tone in my voice, or even honestly, what I sincerely try to get going inside the black box of my own mind. Because as appropriate, it's okay to ask for things to happen in the other person's mind. Could you give me your full attention when I'm speaking, right? Rather than flipping through the Macy's ad or looking or channel surfing or texting somebody, right? I mean, it's okay to ask for that inside the mind of another person. So that's the operationalizing part. And then the last thing I'll say is really watch your tone. Humans are extremely sensitive to tone. One of the great books about communicating, Deborah Tannen's, I forget her co-author's name, book on You Just Don't Understand. It's about gender styles of communicating, but it's really broader than masculine, feminine styles. It really goes to multiculturalism in the workplace and in life in general. How do we communicate with each other and not privileging one dialect over another dialect? So if you take into account tone, you're addressing one of the three most important parts of the communication. Tannen points out that communications have three parts. There's the explicit content. Second, there's the tone. And third, there's the implicit statement about the relationship. Interestingly, as humans, we usually pay most attention to the second and third components of a communication because that's the really important stuff, tone and the underlying message about our standing or the nature of our relationship and who gets to help whom, right? Who gets to be the knower and who gets to be the learner, for example? Who gets to be right and who gets to be wrong? That's what we really pay attention. That's what really matters. But most communications training is about content, even though that's the least important of the three. So I pay a lot of attention to tone. I don't walk on eggshells, but I am very aware of how vulnerable we are, be my last point, to threat. We're, you know, rule one in the wild is, as we evolved, eat lunch today, don't be lunch today. Fear was the first emotion. We're very vulnerable to fear. And so I try to take into account how I might constitute a threat to another person in terms of my impact. It's not my intent. My intent is benign or at least neutral. But the impact could be, in that person's mind, something threatening. So I pay attention to that possibility.
Yep.
I, again, don't walk on eggshells, but I watch my tone. Okay. Hope that was helpful. I don't know.
Yeah, it's great. That's fantastic. And next topic I want to cover is on really dealing with limiting beliefs and sort of letting go of the past. I find that this is an area that is very problematic for people moving forward, and people really struggle with this and spend a lot of time trying to move forward in these areas. And I wanted to really find out what's your take on that. Like, how can people move beyond their own limiting belief set and letting go of the past, and kind of like what practical things can people do around those areas?
Could you give me an example, Jason, of a limiting belief?
Yeah, I would say to people that, you know, I'm trying to think of a real good one here.
I've had a few moments.
You know, I think that, you know, all people really just want to take from other people, and that really giving doesn't really apply. And I think there are people that have that, or that a lot of people that come to us are social anxiety. They're like, well, if I go out, people really don't want to talk to me. You know, when I go up and talk to them, they're really not that interested in really having a conversation with me.
Right.
So therefore, I don't even start one.
I think
that's one of them. And then they've had all these past experiences where they internalize it. Like, they'll go up and have a conversation with someone, and that person may walk away or do something, and then they take it, internalize it as they're bad, or that person didn't like them, without actually getting the facts. And that person may have left the conversation because they had a lead. Maybe they were having a really bad day. They don't even get the facts, and so people internalize all these things, and then they form their belief structure, and then create a lot of it. We see clients come to us, a lot of social anxiety, and going out and really just meeting people and living their lives.
Mm-hmm. Right. This is great. So, first off, I think that it really helps to have a value on being in reality. And what I mean by that sounds kind of cosmic, doesn't it? I really mean it's sort of simple.
Yes.
When we grow up, as we grow up, for many kids, they face a fateful choice, and it shows up in lots of ways, large and small. And the fateful choice is between, are they messed up or am I messed up? Whether that's the other kids in school or in the neighborhood or their siblings, their family, the culture altogether, you know, the grown-ups, the sports coach, what have you. Are they messed up or am I messed up? And most kids make the sort of understandable but wrong choice, and they conclude that they're messed up. When in fact, really, it's mostly out there, if not entirely. You know, their parents are having a bad day. Their dad drinks a little too much. The kids in the neighborhood are just sort of mean and getting off on shaming you and making you feel bad about yourself, and so on. And so we form this idea that is a false belief. And to really get on your own side and to be in reality is to value waking up from that nightmare and seeing through the veils, as it were, to what's really true. And taking your refuge, taking your stand in your capacity deep down inside your own mind to see what's really true, which is the first thing that tyrants try to take control of when they take over a country. You know, the first thing that happens in a coup d'etat, right, is they take over the TV station and the radio stations and the newspapers. They want to control what people think is true. And you see subtler versions of that in corporate environments and business environments. You see subtler versions of that in, you know, political messaging and also in family systems or groups of any kind, or even in relationships. So fighting, holding on to your capacity to discern what you believe yourself to be factual, knowing that your perceptions are fallible, you're going to make mistakes, your views are partial, but that said, you do have the capacity to form a clearer and clearer view of what's actually true. Hold on to that. That's really fundamental. That's number one. Number two, know that your brain is biased. You know, Mother Nature is whispering well-intended lies into your head all day long. She wants you to feel more threatened than you really deserve to feel. She wants you to underestimate opportunities so you live to see the sunrise, and she wants you to underestimate resources inside yourself and out in the world for taking care of the threats in your life or fulfilling your opportunities. That's a great way to keep animals alive, including early humans, living, in fact, fairly recently, right? Our great-great-great-great-great-great-grandparents, if not even sooner. I mean, I'm reading a Dickens novel right now, and just 150, 170 years ago, life sucked for a lot of people. So, you know, in that larger context, it makes sense for Mother Nature to basically delude us in subtle and not so subtle ways about the threats and the opportunities and the resources in our lives. But that's a bias. That's inaccurate. So we can push through that. I, for example, had a major insight, you know, in my 20s that growing up I'd been a nerd, not a wimp. And that was a very important thing to recognize that was actually true for me growing up. And in the same way, we can mistrust, you know, some of the views or voices inside our own mind. They're guilty until proven innocent. I mean, frankly, the metaphor I use in my own mind is I think about the press secretary for the North Korean government. Oh, yeah, we all like grass soup. No one's hungry here. You know, as soon as I recognize that inner voice, that inner perspective, you know, that grumbling case against other people or that kind of excessive self-criticism or that negativistic voice, you know, don't stick your neck out, you'll get nailed, you'll get hammered down. As soon as I recognize the source of that view, I don't believe it so much. It's guilty until proven innocent. And then I'll say the last thing here, which is to risk the dreaded experience. What I mean by that is that most of what the structure of most personal impairments and living small and playing small boils down to not wanting to risk dreaded experiences. These were experiences that we either had when we were a kid or saw other people having them or in adulthood as well, or we imagined could occur. And yes, there is a place for not jumping off buildings or telling your boss off or something like that. But on the other hand, usually the experiences we avoid having, you know, speaking from our heart, taking a chance, starting our own business, asking for love, telling somebody we like them, being one level more disclosed in a relationship, softening and opening to actually receive what another person is saying, openly admitting fault and moving on. We avoid these everyday experiences because we dread what we'll feel if they happen. But the truth is, today, we won't, first of all, the bad event will usually not occur. It did occur a lot when we were kids, but it usually won't occur these days because we're living with different people, you know what I mean? And also, yes, we have many more resources. And even if we did feel bad, we would feel bad for a few minutes, certainly not for years or something like that. So it's rational, in a cost-benefit marginal analysis, if you will, to risk the dreaded experience. And then when it goes well, to finish up, really take it in. When you pressure test one of your self-limiting beliefs and you risk the dreaded experience that self-limiting belief serves the function of protecting you from. Self-limiting beliefs serve functions, right? Follow the money. In other words, who benefits? What's the function that the self-limiting belief serves? If you risk the experience that the self-limiting belief is designed to help you avoid, and when, usually, not if, when it actually goes well, let it in. Take it in. Take that extra 10, 20 seconds, you know, that I've talked about previously to learn the good lesson so you increasingly become free, because deep down it's an autonomy issue. We are the puppets being jerked around by our self-limiting beliefs, right? When you become freer about that self-limiting belief, take it in so you can be freer and freer in the way you live and work and act with other people.
That's fantastic. I love that. Everyone, pay attention to that closely, because that will definitely help you get past a lot of your hurdles. Well, Rick, we have covered a ton today and so many nuggets and wonderful things that everyone should listen to this and take action immediately, because what we know is if you don't take action immediately, you will never take it. So thanks again, Rick. And so how can you talk to people about how people can reach out to you? I know you have a newsletter, you have other resources on your site, books, kind of what you can tell listeners and people out there that want to get in touch with you and find out more.
Oh, thank you very much. Well, I have a ton of freely offered material at my website, rickhansonson.net, rickhansonson.net. And I see that's the bottom line. Just check that out. You'll see tons of PowerPoint slide sets from talks and workshops I've given. You're very welcome to use that material yourself. Articles I've done, audios of talks, videos. I have a lot of video material. And I also have links to other major resources in the area of really the practical application of all this fantastic cutting-edge information and research that's being done in neuroscience. So bottom line, rickhansonson.net. I also have a free weekly newsletter you can find at my website called Just One Thing. It goes out weekly. It's free. I'll never share your email address with anybody, and I'm the easiest guy in the world to unsubscribe from. I don't like getting stuff I don't want to receive in my email inbox. I never want to send somebody something they don't want to get. So the newsletter, Just One Thing, is a practice. It focuses on a practice. The one that you talked about just a little while ago is called Relax. You're going to be criticized, you know. In other words, kind of lighten up about it. And so
yeah.
You can also get that newsletter, too. So rickhansonson.net.
Wonderful.
And on that page, I should say, you can find out about the free bonus offer for pre-ordering
yes.
Hardwiring Happiness.
Yes, that's awesome. And the great month of October. So that's something for everyone to look forward to in the fall. Well, thanks again, Rick. I really appreciate it. And if you want to find out more about what we're doing, you can go to BrentSmithLifestyle.com, and I will talk to you all later.